Thanks for the gracious introduction, Neil, and also to Neil and Tim Schiff for the invite. I had been really excited to come to Perimeter, and obviously world events got in the way. I hope that there will be an opportunity in future, but part of my hope for this talk is to make an introduction to you so that if people are excited about engaging scientifically, we can do that. And so what I suggest, normally when one visits for a colloquium, there's a schedule of a day of meeting with people. What I suggest is that this colloquium can be an advertisement. And if people get back, Neil, maybe I can volunteer you, but if people get back to Neil and say, I'd enjoy talking with David, then let's schedule in the near future a day where we do that, where we just do it remotely. But and in the interest of that, I just want to say briefly a bit about my interest beyond what I'm going to talk about today. I'm interested in how electrons behave at the nanoscale, how things are different when we squeeze down to two dimensions or one dimensions or zero dimensions, small boxes of electrons. So my longest standing thread of work is on what's now popularly called quantum emulation, building experimental realizations of interesting Hamiltonians, and I'm especially interested in many body systems that are sort of at the edge of what can be computed using theoretical techniques. And so, starting with Kondo effect, a single spin in a bath of electrons, but that's something that I've carried on for the last 20 years, and I'd be really excited to engage with people who are interested in that. It's often structures that look rather similar to what are used for building qubits, but I'm interested in many body physics, not in isolating the individual objects. Beyond that, I've been looking at 2D materials. That's what atomically thin 2D materials. That's what I'll focus on today, and then topological systems. You'll hear a bit about topology today, but I've also worked on other classes of topological insulators, things that are analogous to quantum Hall effect, if you're familiar with that, but at zero magnetic fields. And finally, looking at patterning conduction and properties in materials using locally patterned very large electric fields. And there, we've been looking at, for example, strontium titanate, a rather unusual superconductor, and making analogs of classic nanoscale objects like quantum point contacts, very narrow links between two reservoirs of electrons that can pass one 1D quantum mode of conduction, or in this case also supercurrent. So that's just an advertisement for some of the things that I'm thinking about, and if any of them pique your interest and you'd like to talk, then please let Neil know. So I chose this title, Can You Make a Magnet Out of Carbon, because I thought it would be provocative and interesting, and I hope it was. I would like to step back and say that this is not how I came to the set of work that I'll talk about. In fact, a magnet was the last thing I was expecting when my group started working on the systems that I'll describe. So I just want you to know that, I'm not trying to sanitize the situation and say, oh, we knew from the beginning we were going to get X, and we designed it, which is the case in some of my research, that it's very strongly motivated by a theoretical model. Here it was more, I would say, a voyage of discovery. So I'm going to start by, I'm going to start by talking about something that, or at least flagging something that I think is probably inescapably familiar in the world of physics today, and that is graphene on a single atomic sheet of carbon. I'm not saying that you know everything about it, but you've surely heard the word. So graphene is a single sheet of what, when it's stacked together in a certain way, becomes graphite, the material out of which pencil leads are made. Although if any of you are tempted to try to write with a pencil on a paper to get sheets of graphene, you should be aware that that the graphite is adulterated in pencil lead. It has clay added to it in order to make it not quite as soft. So you should definitely start with a graphite crystal if you want to peel off layers. So in graphite, graphene is stacked in a particular way. If you think about the electronic properties of a single sheet of graphene, which were actually calculated more than half a century ago, many of you have probably heard that that they have a very distinctive property that electron energy is proportional to momentum, to inverse wavelength, basically. And that's quite different from what we're used to in most materials. In most materials, energy for electrons goes quadratically with momentum, just like for an electron at non-relativistic speeds in free space, and just like a baseball if you throw it, or I suppose I should say a hockey puck. So the energy linearly proportional to momentum is distinctive. That was exciting to people when they were starting to look at graphene. What are the consequences of that behavior? And it's not just that energy is linearly proportional to momentum, just like we're familiar with for massless particles like photons, but actually the equations describing the electrons look very much like the Dirac equation for massless fermions, but in two dimensions and with spin replaced by another quantity. And so that's, there's a lot that's cool about monolayer graphene. What I want to emphasize now is that that if you start stacking graphene together, put more than one layer on top, then how you stack it matters a lot in terms of the behavior. You might imagine that you would get just two copies of the monolayer graphene, but that's not true, because when one atom is sitting nearly on top of another atom, their tunneling modifies the electronic properties. And so, for example, if you stack two layers of graphene exactly on top of each other, which is not a stable state, it's not something that's that you'd ever find in nature, and it may in fact be impossible to build on reasonable scale. But if you could do that, then it would pretty dramatically change the electronic properties. You would still have this linear relation between energy and momentum, but it would be shifted up and down in energy relative to the energy of the highest electrons filled in the system, which is shown by the horizontal line here. A more realistic situation is what a piece of natural graphite is built by having two layers stacked on top of each other with an offset, so that half of the atoms in the top layer sit on top of atoms in the bottom layer, and half of the atoms in the top layer sit in the middle of empty hexagons in the bottom layer. And there, something pretty unusual happens if you just do two layers in so-called Bernal stacking. You get something that doesn't look so different from the ordinary quadratic behavior of energy versus momentum for a baseball or for a non-relativistic free electron. But very unusually, these two energy momentum dependencies in the so-called conduction band and valence band exactly touch each other. And normally, and you're used to the fact that when you have degeneracies in quantum mechanics, that generally opens up a gap, and you have some so two things that should cross, but then a gap is opened. You have near the gap usually a quadratic relationship to some parameter, but then there's a gap. Here there's no gap, and so that's an unusual thing. So just like monolayer graphene, this system has states available at every energy at low energies, but there are a lot more states at low energy than in monolayer graphene, because you have a different dependence. So I just wanted to give you a sense of some of the zoo of behaviors you can get just by taking graphene and stacking it in different ways. And now I'm going to talk about a kind of engineered energy momentum dependence that I think is particularly intriguing. And I guess before going over to that, let's just look at one of these bands up here, and ask if we fill electrons, if we put a certain number of electrons in a system, or let's just imagine that we have a parabolic dependence of energy versus momentum, and we put some number of electrons in, how are we going to choose which states to fill? And at this point, I may ask you questions, which is tricky over Zoom, but in general, I want to take the opportunity to invite you to jump in if there's something unclear, but also if you want to ask about some possibility. You needn't wait till the end of the talk. I'm not looking at the chat, so if you want to ask something, call out and ask it. You can unmute yourself, or you may be able to alert Neil and have him ping me. So if you have some set of states with given momentum and given energy, and you put some number of electrons into them, how do you decide which states get filled? So you're going to fill the states that have the lowest kinetic energy, so the lowest energy on this curve, and therefore you'll fill certain momentum states. You'll fill up to a Fermi level. So you'll as you know, because of Pauli exclusion, you can only put one electron into each state. So you're going to fill up and up and up until you run out of electrons, and all the states below are going to be filled and all the states above empty. And that's something that's a paradigm that allows us to say a lot about the, predict a lot and describe a lot about the properties of many, many materials. And so now I'm going to suggest what happens when this paradigm breaks down, and can we make it break down? So if you take two layers of graphene, and instead of stacking them rotationally aligned to each other, you have a small twist angle between them, then the way in which they stack will change spatially and periodically. And you can see that there's this periodic pattern that's known as moiré, which is, interestingly, it's from a word, I guess, appropriately for Canada, though not necessarily for your part of Canada. It's a word that was translated into French and then came back into English. So it's mohair, very fine and shimmery fabric mohair that became moiré in French and then came back to English. So this periodic pattern, as the two lattices beat against each other, is very much like what you get when you play a musical instrument, you have two people playing nearly the same note, let's say when they're tuning up to for a performance, and the two notes are almost exactly the same frequency, but they're not exactly the same. And so the two go in and out of phase with each other, in and out of registry, and you hear, and the period of that beat tells you how far off you are in frequency. So similarly, if you take two lattices that are not exactly the same period or that are twisted with respect to each other, they go in and out of registry and make this kind of pattern. So that may seem like a curiosity, but remember that the behavior of electrons in materials is the behavior of electrons in periodic potentials. And now we've created a new periodic structure. And so you might expect that that would change the states that electrons can occupy, and indeed it does. So the electronic structure, you know, for people who are not expert in condensed matter physics, we don't need to go into this in great detail, but this is a map in momentum space, and if momentum being the inverse of real, the Fourier transform of real space, so each point on this refers to a certain period in real space, or one over a period. And the Dirac points, the points where the electrons' energy, momentum, behavior cross, are at quite high momentum, it turns out, not around zero momentum. These are called the K point and the K prime point. If we twist, then we have different K points in the two layers. And I mentioned that you get a new electronic structure that produces a new momentum space picture that spans the two K points in one layer, the two K prime points in the other layer. So looking at this maybe in a somewhat more intuitive way, we get this energy that is linearly proportional to momentum in one layer, also in the other layer, but at a different point in momentum space. And how far away those are depends on what was the twist angle between the two. So now if we, and this is an idealized picture, but the two layers are not independent. So we might expect that when the two behaviors cross, as I alluded to earlier, these degenerate states hybridize and produce two states above and below. So that the two cones of energy and momentum, energy as a function of momentum, get disturbed when they cross each other. So now you can ask, what's going to happen when this gap that's opened is comparable to how far away the gap is from zero energy? So let's go to small twist angle. Then you might expect that the energy would become possibly flat with momentum. So why is that interesting and important? Well, I said before that the whole way that we think about electrons in metals, and turns out in semiconductors, many materials, is that we fill up all of the available states up to a certain energy, and then not above that energy. And then all of the action, all of the electronic properties, conduction, occurs right around the Fermi level, the energy to which we filled the electrons. But what if we had energy independent of momentum? Then there would be no motivation to fill one state over another on the basis of kinetic energy. And you could imagine, well, now electrons will occupy states in order to minimize their Coulomb energy, in order to avoid each other most efficiently. And in condensed matter physics, these sorts of situations where Coulomb interactions among the electrons determine the collective states are really rich, and basically anything can happen. So you can get superconductivity, magnetism, new kinds of correlated insulators. And so being able to design a system that has this property that energy, kinetic energy, is the same for many different electronic states. So electrons can choose their states in order to minimize Coulomb interactions, could be a rich playground. And in fact, quantum Hall effect discovered 4 decades ago is the paradigmatic example of energy independent of momentum, because in a high magnetic field, in a 2D sheet of electrons, you get lots of electrons all circulating, or lots of electronic states that all circulate at the same frequency and all have the same energy. And so which ones you fill can be determined by Coulomb interactions. So up to a couple of years ago, there was no way to achieve this except by putting a very high magnetic field on a system. But now I've sketched out what was proposed by Alan MacDonald and others about a decade ago, that there could be a way to get energy independent of momentum, or a so-called flat band, at zero magnetic field. And the reason I'm telling you this is that 2 years ago, Pablo Jaramillo Herrera's group, in fact, showed that you can do this and that some really exciting surprises come out. So I mentioned that if you have a flat band, then correlations, electrons, interactions with each other should be important. Alan MacDonald had calculated that at about 1.1 degree twist angle between the two layers, you should get a flat band. This is a more detailed calculation by Tim Kaxiris's group at Harvard, suggesting that when you take into account how the two layers relax, you should actually get not just the band flattening, but there should be an isolated band and then a gap to other states. So we might be able to get physics that's all happening within this set of states that are energy independent of momentum. Indeed, 2 years ago, Pablo's group showed that some substantial surprises occurred. I'm not giving all the details now, but I just want to say one can change the filling of electrons in one of these systems by tuning a nearby so-called gate electrode. And this plot is showing resistance of a sample as a function of this gate electrode, which tunes the density of carriers, and also as a function of temperature. And red means high resistance. And so you can see there are these states that seem to be pretty high resistance, even down to low temperature. At other fillings, you have states that look like metals. They're low resistance at low temperature and getting lower at low temperature. And then you have these states that seem to be zero resistance and are superconductors. And so this was really exciting. There wasn't an expectation that superconductivity should occur here. People had searched for superconductivity in graphene without success. And so that was really exciting, and even more tantalizing, this superconductivity occurred just next to a situation where there was an insulator that is not explainable in a simple way from band structure. That's labeled as a mod insulator here. And this is very reminiscent of what happens in high temperature superconductors in the cuprates. And so this got everyone, including me, very excited. It took a while, but that same year, other groups started to also see superconductivity under similar circumstances. It's tricky because, as I'll explain, every sample is made one by one in an artisanal way, and every sample is different, but still this developed as a pattern. My group, which had also been on stacking layers of 2D materials, was really excited, and we decided let's try to reproduce this and extend it. And so let me just say briefly, there's a pretty remarkable set of technologies that are used to make this, remarkable in part because they're so low tech, that one uses, as you may have heard, scotch tape to peel single atomic layers from a material and stack it on another. And this is showing you that if you sandwich an atomically thin material between the right inert insulating layers, which turned out to be hexagonal boron nitride, which is atomically flat, then you can make this 2D layer very clean and isolated from its environment. Even though it's atomically thin, it can have remarkably clean electronic properties. And in order to do this, you need to be able to make contact to the very edge of this sample. You know, appropriate, I'm sure no one's said this before, but that this is appropriate for Perimeter Institute. And amazingly, you can make good contact to the very edge of the sample, to this last nanometer, by just depositing metal on the edge of this. So there's technology that allows you to do this, but in a sense, it's not, this is something that's been developed in a set of stages and is now pretty widely available. So here's a picture of a completed sample that has a gate electrode on top. It has a twisted bilayer in the middle, and has a number of electrical contacts for making making measurements. And let me just show you the kind of data that we can take here. So in this sample, we have a gate electrode on top and on the bottom. And what that means is that we can tune one of the gate electrodes and we can change the density of carriers in the 2D sheet, you know, filling or emptying this flat band. But if we adjust one, just a moment, I'm going to close the door so that it's quieter.
No problem.
If we change one electrode to be more positive and the other electrode to be more negative, so we would move along one of these features in the this color map of resistance of the sample. And so the density of carriers would not change. Here I'm showing that as N in the direction of the upper right arrow. When we change the two voltages in the same direction, we're changing density. But if we go along top left to bottom right direction, we're not changing density, but we're changing the electric field normal to the plane, which sometimes can make a big difference in these samples. So so what I'm plotting here is the resistance of the sample on a color scale as a function of these two voltages. And it's a logarithmic scale. The resistance changes quite dramatically up to sort of megohm level and down to 100 ohms. So this, looking at this kind of plot, there are things that can jump out. Just to orient you, this line is the density where it's called charge neutrality. It's the where, for example, the two Dirac cones meet each other in graphene. This is where things will tend to be roughly at zero voltage on both gates. If you go up to the right, you're filling this flat band. And if you go down to the left, you're emptying the flat band. And these big resistive regions at the top right and bottom left are the gap when you've completely filled or completely emptied this flat band. And this feature in the middle that's also resistive is an example of a place where you wouldn't naively think that there would be an insulator, a gap formed, but there is. So that's just what you can get at a glance here. Let's look in more detail. It turned out that we had done something accidentally on this first sample. We didn't realize it until looking back at photos of the construction of it, but we had accidentally taken one of these supposedly inert layers that we were sandwiching the twisted bilayer graphene with, and we had accidentally aligned its lattice with the lattice of the graphene. To within 1 degree. And in this sample, and then we can look at another sample where we intentionally misaligned the boron nitride lattice, which is what had either intentionally or not been the case in all devices people had made before that for looking at superconductivity and twisted bilayer graphene. So let's compare these two. In the case where the graphene was not aligned, I've now transformed the axes that I showed you before so that the horizontal axis is density and the vertical axis is electric field normal to the plane. And density I've also normalized so that one is completely filling a band, completely filling the flat band, and minus one is completely emptying. So you can see that there's relatively resistive state at zero and at complete filling and at complete emptying of the band, and then there's some interesting structure in between. If we now look at the one where the boron nitride is aligned, it looks generically similar. And if you look at the two, they bear some substantial resemblance, but let's look closer. And I like to say that these color maps can be very revealing. Things can jump out from them, but they can also hide a multitude of sins. So I feel like to get quantitative about anything, it's really important to do line cuts through here. And so that's what I'm setting out to do. I've shown a dashed line in each of these in which just the density is changed. And if you look at the resistivity in this sample, in this unaligned sample versus density, and I apologize for the low density of points. I didn't design this 2D color map for this purpose, but you can see that there are peaks in resistance at zero, at complete filling of the band, complete emptying of the band, also at half filling and half emptying. There's some structure there. If we look at the aligned case, the same is true. There's maybe some additional structure, but if you look carefully, these are log scales, and the resistance, the resistivity at charge neutrality is about 2 kilo-ohms in the case of the non-aligned with boron nitride. And that's actually pretty typical for graphene. Even though you go to zero density, it doesn't actually become an insulator because as the density gets lower, the mean free path gets larger, and symmetry protects in graphene the metallic behavior. You should never get localization in graphene unless you disrupt its symmetry. So this is sort of standard, and this is about what people seen in twisted bilayer graphene also. It's quite different in the case when you align with boron nitride. Again, something we didn't do intentionally. Here, the resistivity goes up to 100 kilo-ohms. And this is actually, the difference, this two order of magnitude difference is actually quite important and relevant because if you say that graphene can't localize, it turns out that it should never have a resistivity higher than about 20 kilo-ohms. And in practice, it tends to be a few kilo-ohms to 10 kilo-ohms. So 100 kilo-ohms is right out. It tells you that something's happened here that is not typical for graphene. And so I just wanted to show you that you can look at just some simple things and see this sample looks different. Another way that it looks different is when you go beyond complete filling of the band, there's another feature out here. Again, when you go beyond complete emptying of the band, there's another feature. It turns out that's related to the moiré formed by the graphene and boron nitride. And that allows us to very precisely determine the angle of that twist. All right, so we can look visually. Again, we didn't do this during the making of the sample, but we took pictures, and you can see that the a facet on the graphene crystal is at essentially the same angle as a facet on the boron nitride crystal. And if we play with it on the computer, we can see they're about 1 degree off. When we measure it electronically by the method I mentioned, it's about 0.8 degrees. So we got accidentally this alignment. Now, we knew already that alignment of graphene with boron nitride can open a gap in the graphene can do something to the graphene that's strong, even though people had thought of the boron nitride as being inert. This is work from my group from 7 years ago, and there was related work from Pablo Jurillo Herrero's group at about the same time. And the idea is that that by breaking the sublattice symmetry in the graphene, you know, some graphene atoms or carbon atoms are sitting on top of boron, some sitting on top of nitrogen, you open up a gap at what would otherwise be a metallic point, the charge neutrality point. So let's think about what these layered structures look like. And so these are just cartoons with the known twist angles that we have. Here's one layer of graphene. Here's a second layer of graphene. And this is to scale. And here's the boron nitride. And when we add them all together, it's kind of interesting that actually the moiré of the graphene and boron nitride almost perfectly overlays the moiré of the graphene and graphene. And we don't actually yet know whether that's important or not, or whether the role of the boron nitride is just to open up, to break a symmetry and open a gap. All right, so I've talked a lot about background because I wanted to give you context, but now let's, my student, Aaron Sharp, cooled down the sample, and one of the first things he was doing, and this was in a simple cryostat at 1.5 Kelvin, he looked at the Hall effect. This is something that's used for diagnosing what's the density and the carrier type in a sample, is it electrons or holes, and he stepped the density by stepping the gate voltage and looked at the Hall effect. And so you can see that the Hall signal is about linear with magnetic field. This is a low magnetic field, just a tenth of a Tesla in either direction. And you can see that there's a Hall slope. And this is at 1/8 filling of this band. I can also state it in other terms. This band can hold, when you go from the charge neutrality point to complete filling, it can hold 4 electrons per moiré cell. And so 1/8 filling is half an electron per moiré cell. We can go to 2 electrons per moiré cell, 2.5 electrons per moiré cell. And you know, in each case, the detailed slope changes, so we can try to map out the carrier density. And then at 3 electrons per moiré cell, it looks a bit different. And this was really surprising. There's this very large slope of the Hall effect near zero magnetic field. It gets up to quite high Hall resistances. So 2 kiloohms is big. It's about a tenth of the resistance you get for the quantum Hall effect, which is where you have a single flat band filled, lambda level filled. And so both the size of this effect and how steep it is near zero field was really striking. And so Aaron decided to, you know, he was disappointed. He hadn't seen superconductivity in the sample, which is what he had looked for. But he decided to cool down this sample at lower temperature. And let me tell you this in steps. You know, first of all, under the right conditions, this anomalous Hall signal, this jump in Hall effect, can be quite large. It's not just 2 kiloohms; it can get up to on the order of 10 kiloohms. But also, the signal turns out not to be the same when you sweep the magnetic field back. And if you sit at zero magnetic field, you can see that you could get either a positive Hall signal or a negative Hall signal, which is really striking. This tells you that this system is magnetic, that you're able to, by the history of the magnetic field that you put on it, you can favor a certain state of the system. And you can go back to zero magnetic field and that state persists. And that was really a shock to us. I mentioned that he cooled this down in a fancier cryostat. it turns out it's not necessary to go to low temperature in that cryostat. This temperature is comparable to the temperature we used before, but this cryostat has much more careful electrical filtering, and so it prevents people's cell phones and other signals from room temperature from exciting the sample, and turns out that's important for maintaining these magnetic states. So, and again, this is at about 3/4 filling of the band, which means 3 electrons per moiré cell. So this was really shocking to us. It wasn't something we were looking for at all. It turns out this ferromagnetism, we mapped it out. It's, let me focus on the red curve on the right. This shows that the size of this Hall signal gets biggest right near 3 electrons per moiré cell. And it's pretty tightly linked to just about 3 electrons per moiré cell. It gets small on either side, doesn't get quite zero as we fill in more and more electrons, but something special is happening at 3 electrons per moiré cell. The blue curve is showing what's the Hall slope extrapolating towards zero field. And you can see that Hall slope is getting larger and larger as you go toward 3/4 filling. And on the other side, it's getting larger and larger in the opposite direction. What that means is that we're going toward a low density of electrons. And then on the right side, we have a low density of holes near this point. So it seems like there might be a gap opened. The fact that these two connect to each other is probably because we get a mix of electrons and holes in between. So it seems like this state probably has a gap, and it's a state that has a big Hall signal. And that should be, for some of you, maybe reminiscent of quantum Hall effect. That's a case where it's an insulator, but it has a finite, in fact, large Hall effect. Let me just go through a couple of other observations. We can go around a Lupin magnetic field multiple times, and the Hall signal has some fine structure, and that fine structure seems to be largely reproducible as we go around this loop. That suggests that that what we have is something that's magnetic, and maybe it has domains of different magnetism that are on the order of the size of the sample, which is a few microns in size, and it seems like the domains switch. Each domain switches at a consistent magnetic field every time around. This magnetism is stable in zero applied magnetic field. So if we set the magnetic state and then wait for 6 hours, which was as long as we had the patience to do, the Hall signal remains. And here's one of these hysteresis loops I showed you. We can do a hysteresis loop, come to zero field, wait for 6 hours, and then continue the hysteresis loop. And it's as if that time never passed. So this magnet, whatever it is quite robust. It only occurs at low temperatures, but not ultra low temperatures. So this magnetism is revealed by hysteresis. You can see it goes up through about 4 Kelvin, and even up to about 5 Kelvin, there's still this jump in Hall signal, but no longer hysteresis. So we can look at the size of the anomalous Hall signal stays basically flat up to nearly 4 Kelvin liquid helium temperature. It actually gets even a little bit bigger as we warm up. Maybe it's easier to align the domains as we warm up. The coercive field, the field required to switch it, goes monotonically down with field and is basically zero by 4 Kelvin. So this is low temperature, but not ultra low temperature. Just to put this together, we have a large Hall effect that seems not to be related just to the density of carriers, not to be just proportional to 1/1 the carrier density. There's an apparent insulating state, domains forming. It looks a lot like early examples of magnetic topological insulators, which were made in telluride-based materials in the starting in 2012 or so, and suggestive of the possibility that what we could be seeing is a Chern insulator, an analog of a quantum Hall state, but at zero magnetic field. And ideally that would have no longitudinal resistivity. For those of you who aren't familiar with this, that also means there's no longitudinal conductivity, which is counterintuitive. If you have a finite Hall resistivity, but no longitudinal resistivity, there's no conduction within the bulk of the sample, but you would expect a quantized value of the Hall resistivity that could be this special combination of Planck's constant and the electron charge squared, that's about 26 kilo-ohms, or some fraction of this. And so if we look for this, we see, well, at 3/4 filling, we do see that the Hall signal gets big. It's on the order of H on E squared, but we don't see zero value of longitudinal resistivity. If you look at longitudinal conductivity, it does have a minimum there, but it doesn't go to zero. And so if we want to see this Chern insulator behavior, which can be thought of as a behavior of circulating states at the edge that are perfect one-dimensional channels that can only go one direction, then we would expect to see this idealized behavior. And why could that happen? Well, I mentioned that when you have a band and you fill it, say halfway, you're going to fill the bottom half of the kinetic energy states and not fill the top half. But what if electrons are able to feel each other and react to each other? Then it might be that if you fill it halfway or 3/4 of the way, you would choose to fill these four effectively degenerate bands that have different spin states and different valley sort of orbital character. You might fill one of these four first, and then the next, and then the next, and then the next. So at 3/4 filling, instead of 3/4 filling all of these states, you might completely fill three of the states and leave one completely empty. And that would be expected to produce a Chern insulator or quantum anomalous Hall insulator. If this were happening, you'd expect to be able to see evidence of this edge conduction. By the way, this idea that the boron nitride could facilitate this sort of symmetry breaking was suggested by a couple of works that were responsive to our work, and other work has suggested that there could even be a spontaneous breaking of the symmetry even without the boron nitride. So I'm going to, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip past this part, except to say that there's a set of traditional measurements one can make in quantum Hall systems to diagnose that to diagnose that you have edge states that go around just one way, and these do in fact show that sort of behavior in our system, even though the bulk doesn't seem to be fully insulating. Following up on our work, a colleague of mine, Andrea Young at Santa Barbara, who's been a leader in these twisted material studies and in 2D materials in general, was inspired to look back at one of his samples and found that it also had boron nitride aligned with the graphene. And when he looked at that, his group saw that actually the Hall effect that they could extract is in fact quantized at H over E squared, and that's robust even up to about 4 Kelvin. So that was a nice validation and a beautiful extension of the work that we did, basically showing that our suspicion that we were seeing a churn insulator or quantum anomalous Hall system was correct. So I think I won't say more about that, except to say that because we need to have two twist angles controlled, not just one, these kinds of samples have proved to be hard to make consistently. So in our sample, we also discovered by accident that we could switch the magnetism not just by magnetic field, but also by driving a current in the plane of the sample. And if you think about your symmetries, the Hall signal is reflecting a magnetization out of the plane. And we're trying to switch it by driving a current in the plane. What determines that a current that's coming toward you should cause the magnetization to switch up, and a current that's coming away from you should cause it to switch down? You have to have some other vector in the system or some other symmetry broken in order to do that. And there are a couple of ideas for what's happening there, but it's not resolved. It's an open question. Why can we switch the magnetization with an in-plane current? But let me just mention two things. One, this was also validated by Andrea Young's work. And secondly, the currents that are needed are extremely small. They're on the order of tens of nanoamps. And even though they're going through a very narrow sheet, if you think about the current densities that are flowing, there are some recent developments in magnetic memories where people are, even commercially, you can get memory for your cell phone, for example, that is stored in tiny magnetic particles. And there, if you look at the switching currents that are needed to switch their state, the state of the art, even in research labs, is 1,000 to 10,000 times higher current density than what we're seeing. So this offers the possibility of really switching with very low power magnetic states, albeit at very low temperature. And so I've been thinking about this as a possible memory for a processor talking to quantum computers. Because as some of you may know, quantum computers can't act on their own. They need to have classical processors controlling them. And ideally those should be really near to the quantum computer and therefore possibly at ultra low temperatures. So I think this is kind of cool. It's another thing that we totally didn't expect and just accidentally discovered. So I want to, in starting to bring this back in, I want to say, we've been talking about a magnet and a churn insulator. Now, what is the nature of the magnet that we're seeing? I asked at the beginning, can we make a magnet out of carbon? And what would that even look like? So if we want to probe the nature of the magnetism, we might want to see what's the effect of a magnetic field oriented in different directions. So here I'm showing you a picture of our sample that's mounted on a so-called chip carrier. It looks somewhat similar to what a computer processor is mounted on in your computer. That chip carrier goes into a socket, and we designed together with a company, AutoCube, a rotation system that could rotate the sample around an entire half sphere relative to the fixed direction of a magnetic field. And so so it's possible to rotate the sample in this phi direction, and also in the theta direction, so the magnetic field is vertical. So theta equals zero is where the field is perpendicular to the sample, everything I've shown you so far, but we can also rotate it so that the magnetic field goes more in the plane of the sample. And here's here's completely in the plane of the sample. So there are possible scenarios for what could be happening. That could give you this strong Hall signal. You could have a system that is the simplest explanation, and the one I think is most likely at this point, is the one that I offered before, that we have these valley states and spin states, and we fill three of the four valley and spin states, not the fourth, and that means that there's a net valley polarization, which gives rise to a magnetism, because these valley states have little circulating currents, and B gives a net circulation, a churn number. So I just want to stop for a moment here and note how strange this is. Even the simplest scenario, when we think about magnets, you know, what gives magnetism to magnets? Maybe when we first hear about magnetism, we hear, oh, magnetism comes from little circulating current loops, and those produce a field, and that's what magnetism is. But quickly we're told, well, really the circulating current loops aren't circulating current loops. They're spin that has an associated magnetic moment, but without any spatial extent. This system appears to be the first example that we know of in experimentally of near zero magnetic field, a magnet being built out of little current loops that the objects that are orienting are the wave functions of electrons, the spatial wave functions that circulate indefatigably in the clockwise or counterclockwise direction, and we can flip that direction with the magnetic field. So that's the simplest scenario. There are other more exotic scenarios that a system that could be valley polarized, so it could have net polarization between K and K prime valleys, but spin unpolarized. That would be analogous to, for those of you who know about fractional quantum Hall effect, it would be analogous to the filling factor 1/2 state, which is a Fermi sea of composite fermions. So that's something quite exotic that Senthil has proposed. Another possibility is it could be not these circulating wave functions at all. It could be spins that point in different directions on a tetrahedron. And when you go around a triangle, these spins point in three directions that produce a net whose triple product gives a net direction. And so there, again, there would be two copies of this. In this case, there would be two copies with two spins. In this case, it would be all built on spins with two copies from valley. We can try to distinguish these by looking at what happens when we put on a magnetic field in different directions, because a field in the plane of the sample is mostly going to couple to spin. I do note that it can couple to the valley degree of freedom also, but mostly it will couple to the spin, whereas a field out of the plane couples to the valley strongly. So if we look at the Hall signal as a function of magnetic field, and we look at different tilt angles, so 0 degrees is what we've been doing so far, 85 degrees is just 5 degrees out of the plane, so the magnetic field is almost in plane. You can see there's a total mess when we plot all these data on top of each other. But if we look at only the perpendicular component of the magnetic field and look at the Hall signal, you can see that largely these collapse, particularly the low field part. So this switching that occurs between magnetic states is really driven by the perpendicular component of the magnetic field. The parallel component almost doesn't matter. Now, that's the proximate story. We can also look at very close to in-plane field, and you can see that there it gets more and more complicated. There are still behaviors that occur even when the magnetic field is perfectly in the plane, and when I say perfectly, I mean to better than a tenth of a degree in the plane, and our calculation is that the out-of-plane component shouldn't be important at that point. We still get some pretty interesting and exotic behavior that I'm happy to talk about later. One more thing about in-plane field, we can also say, let's magnetize the sample normal to the plane, then rotate it, so now the field is in-plane. And here's where we start when we've just rotated it. The And now we're turning on a magnetic field that's in the plane, and we can see that something pretty strong occurs at around 5 or 6 Tesla. And then everything's sort of stable. And then when we sweep the field down, there's no hysteresis until we get below this 5 Tesla, and now it departs from its original state. And so it seems like there's some state that's occurring when we've polarized out of the plane that is different from what happens when we then put an in-plane field, and different again from what happens at high in-plane field where there's no hysteresis. So this is it's a story in progress. So we don't have the answer about what this magnet is, and I'd be excited to have discussions with people, but I just wanted to give you a sense of the kinds of surprises that can occur and the things that we can learn about them. So as I wrap up, I just want to mention, I told you that this is a pretty low-tech process. So I just wanted to show you a little bit about that. Here's a piece of glass, just a glass slide that you'd use in a biological lab. It has a squishy polymer called PDMS that's used in microfluidics. It has on top of that a sticky polymer, polycarbonate, and then that acts as a stamp to pick up atomic monolayers that we've prepared. And this is not our invention. This is something that's been developed elsewhere, notably at Columbia, but we've added some insights to this. This is the system that we use to take the stamp on a glass slide that's held in this right-hand holder and move it relative to the sample that's held on this central holder by vacuum, and it's sitting under a microscope. You can see a couple of these controls are, a couple of these particularly critical controls, for example, for rotation angle, are now computer controlled. Others are controlled manually. And I just want to note that in this field, a large part of the fun that's occurred in this field, and I think also the success of the field, has been that the leaders of the field have been very generous in showing people how to do things. So so after Pablo's group demonstrated these amazing superconducting behaviors in twisted bilayer graphene, I called him up and he said, you know, send your student over and we'll show him how to do the stacking, because we hadn't done careful rotational control before. And so so Aaron was preparing to go to Boston, and he heard that there was a blizzard coming. And so he booked his flight, and an hour later was at the airport and headed to Boston, landed. The blizzard sure enough hit, and they Pablo and his students were kind enough to come in anyway and show Aaron their technique. And I think that we've really benefited from that, and we've tried to pay that forward as well and helping others learn how to do this. So none of this is secret sauce that we're trying to maintain a technical advantage. We want to help people do a do work like this. So I just wanted to summarize where we've come. So twisted bilayer graphene turns out to be a Chern insulator when there are 3 electrons added per Moré cell. Not, for example, when there's 1 electron added per Moré cell, and we don't yet fully understand that. The alignment to boron nitride appears to be crucial to break some symmetry and to enable these topologically non-trivial states. The magnet seems to be our first example of an orbital ferromagnet, one that is not primarily based on spin. It acts like an icing system. It really, it only wants to be up or down. Maybe in very high magnetic field, some different state occurs, but otherwise it appears to be just up or down, meaning circulating counterclockwise or clockwise. If we put on a big in-plane field, we can kill the magnetization. So probably, and we don't know what's happening at those very high magnetic fields. And I do want to say I focused on this one material system, but I did say at the beginning, you know, you can stack graphene in a bunch of different ways. And it turns out that two other systems have shown this basic kind of magnetism and topological behavior. One of them is ABC trilayer graphene, where the graphene is not rotated one with respect to another layer, but in a particular registry in the three layers. And that's work that my group has done together with Feng Wang at Berkeley, who first seized on that system and showed how to identify it. He was not the first to seize on that system. In our work together, he brought that to me and said, we think trilayer graphene is really exciting. There too, the symmetry is broken by alignment to HBN, to boron nitride. And then another system taking bilayer graphene, Bernal stack bilayer, like I showed you at the beginning, and twisting that with respect to monolayer graphene is yet a third system that's shown this kind of behavior. So I think it's going to be a rich playground, but because there are so many control parameters, even in just making the sample, and because those parameters are not perfectly controlled, as you can imagine with a system like this, you can't dial in, you know, 1.20 degrees and be sure that you're going to get it to a hundredth of a degree. Things slip. I think that this way of making samples one at a time in an artisanal manner, basically using the student's careful skill, I think that we're going to really, to take the next steps in this field, we're going to need to make larger area, more systematized samples. And so that's a large focus of what I'm working on now. How can we make 100 samples that are all the same, or 100 that are different in a systematized way, like we've gotten used to in semiconductor systems. So I'd like to acknowledge the people who made this happen. Aaron Sharp led this work. He's just about to graduate from my group, and he's starting a prize postdoc position at Sandia National Lab, probably spending most of his time in Sandia and Livermore. Eli Fox, another tremendously talented student who has led a lot of our work on topological systems. A number of other people from my group have played a key role. Mark Kastner, who I was privileged to have as a thesis advisor many years ago, has moved to California, and he likes to say become a postdoc in my group. Although I'm not sure I'd keep a postdoc who doesn't turn the knobs in lab, he's actually the most fantastic discussion partner for me and my students. And none of this would be possible without the materials that we start with, notably the boron nitride that's grown by a team in Japan, Watanabe and Taniguchi. I didn't talk a lot about magnetic topological insulators, but that's what first got me thinking about these kinds of phenomena. And we've worked a lot with some materials from Kang Wang's group at UCLA. And in the list of many others who have been important, I want to highlight my late colleague, Shou-Cheng Zhang, who really inspired me to think about topological systems. And I think not just me, but many people in the world. So he played a key role in elucidating a lot of the theory of these systems, but I think he also played a unique role in exciting people about them. And I know that I wouldn't be doing what I am today without that. So so with that said, let me close and invite questions.
All right, well, thank you, David, very much for, yeah. Okay, well, let's all just, I guess, like virtually applaud, or we can, you know, turn on the microphone and applaud. It's all applaud for everyone, maybe.
That's fine, yes, but I'd be here. Thanks.
We are a bit over time.
Sure, sorry.
But just briefly, do people have any questions for David? People can either unmute themselves or they can raise their hand.
I have a question, David. This is Darren. I have a question that can you say a bit more? So based on your picture, you expected churn into it also at one quarter filling, like just based on the band structure. So is that seen, or if not, and if not, do you have any understanding of why not? And
yeah, so thanks, Tarun. So what? Let me just try to navigate to the correct. So I think this is probably a good place to go. So this cartoon picture says we have four effectively degenerate bands, and we could fill them all equally, or we could fill just some of them. And so at one quarter filling, we might just fill one band. That's what this cartoon suggests. So that's in a perfectly flat band case. In fact, this is not a perfectly flat band. All of the energy scales in the system are actually comparable. So the Coulomb charging energy, the kinetic energy of dispersion of this band, even the spacing to the next band, they're all of the same order. And so the details probably do matter. And so it's not a shock that that it shouldn't be symmetric for three quarters and one quarter filling, let alone for minus one quarter and minus three quarters filling, which also have a similar scenario. What I can say tantalizingly is that now in several systems, in twisted bilayer graphene, in the ABC trilayer graphene, in the twisted monolayer bilayer graphene, in all of them, there's a band that's three quarters filled that gives this behavior. And whether that's, whether that's telling us anything, I don't know, but.
Basically, interesting. Okay. Okay, yeah, thank you.
Hi, David.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks for the very nice talk. I just had a couple questions. So I guess in the spirit of Shosheng Zhang, I wanted to ask about the possibility of like a doped quantum Hall, quantum anomalous Hall insulator that goes superconducting. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've thought about like the possibility of topological superconductors in these systems. Or...
Yes, indeed. So thanks, Tim. That's a great question. So in these, I mentioned that the reason that we got into this was because of the discovery of superconductivity in the system, and then we didn't find superconductivity. By the way, in the second sample that I showed early on, and in other samples, we've seen superconductivity as of a bunch of other groups around the world. So, but in this sample and in other samples that have been seen to show the topological magnetic order, superconductivity does not show up. With the exception of the ABC trilayer graphene, where it appears, and this is my work where we reported signatures of superconductivity. I mentioned, I guess this is the gun that was shown in the first act and then never shot until now, but the, this is, in Chekhov's play, there's the gun on the table and it has to be shot by the end of the third act. So I mentioned that the electric field normal to the plane can be important. And in ABC trilayer graphene, actually by reversing that electric field, you can reverse the topological character of the bands from trivial to topological. So for one direction of that electric field, we see something that looks like this emergent churn insulator, and for the other direction, we see things that look like superconductors. So there is at least a suggestion that in one sample, we can get both of them. Another possibility is that you could have a sample where there's a thin layer of boron nitride that's aligned with the graphene, but it doesn't cover all of the graphene. And then you might expect that you could get superconductivity on the side that doesn't have the boron nitride aligned and magnetism on the other side. So I'm keenly interested and excited about the possibility of creating topological superconductivity in this sort of system. And also in the chalcogenide-based tellurium sort of magnetic topological insulators. And I'm actively thinking about both of those. Anyone who has ideas for what would be the right experiment to do to elucidate that, if we could build a structure with some arbitrary geometry of topological superconductor and magnet, I'd be really interested.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, actually, I had another question that's much more speculative. So you mentioned this interesting possible application of this current switching as a classical interface for a quantum computer.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there's any possibility of building qubits in this system directly. You know, one has these magnetic states, but maybe they're hard to superpose. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
Have you thought about that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think that in Moiré systems, the idea of building qubits in Moiré systems, I think, is a very good one, and is, you know, you could imagine having an array of them. Of mm-hmm. course, getting them to have the right strength of coupling to each other might require some tuning. My guess is that these systems particularly, and you know that big magnets, it's hard to superimpose their states. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's some beautiful studies on macroscopic coherence of magnets going back to work by Miriam Sarachik's group and others. But generally, it's much easier to superimpose spin 1/2 than spin 10, let alone 100. Furthermore, these seem to be very anisotropic, and so they're icing-like. So that doesn't lend itself to the full set of control that you might want for. I think it doesn't for generalized quantum computation. So my guess is, but I'd be happy to discuss with anyone here. My guess is that. Bigger chunks of magnets are probably not ideal for quantum computing, but I'd love to be challenged on that.
Mm. Thanks.
Okay, so in the interest of time, we should probably stop here. Okay. So let's thank David once again.